Who has heard the phrase or the saying, you can't go home again? What does it mean? It's never the same. Has anyone ever experienced this before? Yeah, I feel like I have too. There are a number of us, I think, here who, at a minimum, we may have lived here as younger people and then moved away for a while and then we came back. And even if the things around us when we came back were more or less the same, some of the things might have changed. Maybe they didn't, but we changed because we went somewhere else. And so going home wasn't the same experience as being home was at the beginning, right? So in our passage today, we saw in Wendy's version, there was a lot of repetition of the word return. Return, return, return. In the NIV, it kind of alternates between returning and going back and all this kind of, but it's this kind of turning concept. And can any of you think of something maybe we've thought about recently or talked about recently here that also had an element of return or turn? Anything like that? Okay, coming back into our building, sure. Jonah, right. Jonah was all about turning, repenting, turning from evil. So the Ninevites we saw turned from their evil, and God turned from the evil that he was going to do to them. And then Jonah, all of this turning to him was evil with great evil. And we saw in that series that there are two directions that you can turn. You can turn away from evil, or you can turn away from God and his mercy, his chesed. So in Ruth, we have, it's a slightly different concept, just like God's mercy in Ruth shows up a little differently than it does in Jonah, but we're still talking about the same thing. In Ruth, the turning, the returning, is a little different too. Ruth is about returning home. So what is it that makes home, home? Familiarity, yep. What? Someone else said something. The love of the people, right. Comfort? Okay, yeah, all of those things, I think, and I'm sure there are many other things we could think of if we had a little more time, but in this story, returning home, in this chapter, returning home is a big concept, and there are two directions, just like in Jonah, there were two directions you could turn. In Ruth, there are two directions you could return. You could return toward the familiar and maybe the expedient or the prudent, or you could turn toward the unfamiliar, the unknown, mercy, love, chesed of God. Our story last week started out a little murkily. We didn't get too far into it because there was so much baggage that we had to unpack for background for the story of Ruth, and it was a little hard to tell who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. We talked about Moab's kind of inauspicious origins and the really complicated relationship between Moab and Israel, and both Moab and Israel are unrighteous peoples in this time period. The Israelites are the people of God, but they, as we know, this takes place in the time of the judges, and so they are just repeatedly disobeying in worse and worse ways. And sometimes it's almost like God has kind of pulled back his presence. He's not even there. And so the story started with a famine. And we just saw an Israelite man whose name means God is king bring his whole family to Moab, supposedly for a sojourn, which would be a short visit. But they ended up staying there 10 years. He dies. The only clue that we have so far in this story about what might be a good direction to turn is in verse 6. Then she, Naomi, or Pleasant, arose, and she and her daughters-in-law, and she returned from the fields of Moab, for She heard in the fields of Moab that Yahweh had visited his people to give them bread. So of the two nations, these two unrighteous nations, the one that Yahweh is visiting is Israel. And our NIV translation doesn't have the term visiting. It just says he came to the aid of his people or something like that. But there are other translations besides Wendy's that have it almost like he showed up there in Bethlehem. Huh. and brought them bread. He ended the famine there. So going back, because Yahweh has visited his people, is a really good move. But just as we saw in Jonah, we're going to discover that in this story, it is again an Israelite who has a problem with God and a non-Israelite who reflects God's character to that person, even if at first they are unwilling or unable to see it. So Naomi returns from the fields, and she and Orpah and Ruth prepare to return home. But it's really only home for one of them, right? It's not really returning for Orpah and Ruth. They've never been there before. They're not from Israel. That's not their home. They can't go back to a place they've never been, can they? And Naomi recognizes this. She is a woman who herself was taken away from her home. We don't know how much she was in agreement with her husband about this move. The Bible doesn't tell us. But one way or another, she's not in her home, and now she's in this place where she's a foreigner and she has nothing. And she also expects that even when she returns home, she will still be an aging widow on a dead-end street. She is choosing to go back to her people because she heard that Yahweh had visited them, that his presence had returned to them, but as we're about to see, she doesn't expect much for herself from Yahweh either. And she doesn't want her daughters-in-law, both of whom seem genuinely and remarkably close to her, their mother-in-law, their foreign mother-in-law, she doesn't want them to suffer what she has already suffered and is probably expecting to continue to suffer even when she goes back home. So she directs them to return to the life that they came from. Here's the thing. When we return anywhere, in large part, it's our expectations that determine where we decide to return and how we get there. So Naomi's expectations, it seems like, from the things that she says in this passage, are that she was a faithful wife and mother. She believes in and belongs to Yahweh. Whether or not she really wanted to go to Moab or expected to live there as long as she ended up living there, she seems to have expected one way or another to live to a nice old age with her husband and have her sons and her daughters-in-law there to take care of her, and they would have kids, and the kids would pass on, the grandkids would pass on the family name, and this is how things are supposed to work in this society, and she was on board with that. She is content with her role in society. She is not looking for liberation from society's constraints or the things that are expected in society. There's no reason for her to, because as a matriarch, that's where her power would have come from. She would have been the female head of this family, and she would have been able to kind of manage the larger family, but have them take care of her, and that's very empowering to a woman at that time. And so now she's got none of that. And for Naomi, like most of us, I think, she has bought into the idea that her culture's expectations of what constitutes the good life is more or less the same thing as God's will for a good life. She thinks this is the way that God has ordained it. It's supposed to be like this, and suddenly it's not there. So I'm going to get a little personal for a second and tell you my Naomi experience. Most of you know that I lived in London for a while in my 20s, and when I was getting ready to turn 30, I felt like God said, you need to go back to the States. But I did not feel like he told me why or what he had for me to do there. And I had been a missionary in London. I was working with people from all over the world, and I was trying to share the gospel, and I was doing all this stuff. And, I was doing this for God, right? And so I come back. I'm 30 years old. I've always wanted to be married, but I've maybe been on enough dates that I could count on one hand. I was super angry and disillusioned and frustrated and kind of really baffled, because I thought, I'm giving my life to God and I'm going to go here and I'm going to be a missionary in another country for the rest of my life. Maybe it's not going to be England the whole time, but I'm never going to go. The States is not my home. I'm going to be somewhere else. And I'm going to meet somebody great who loves the Lord too, and we're going to get married, and we're going to have a family, and we're going to do all this stuff. And then suddenly I'm back here, and not only do I not have even a boyfriend, but I'm not a missionary anymore. I'm working at Starbucks. I don't know what my calling is. All of my expectations seemed to be godly expectations, right? Anything wrong with those? Totally not how it worked out for me. So I get where Naomi's coming from. Here's the thing. God's desire for Naomi, for me, for us, first of all, it's not to just arbitrarily thwart our own desires or for us to be unhappy for some reason. That's not what his desire is. But his desire is for every person of any gender to become more fully the person that he created. Not according to our culture, but according to his nature, which is chesed. So Naomi could have, her husband could have lived and her sons could have lived and they could have had grandkids and she could have stayed in Moab for her whole life. And we, most of us, already kind of know the end of this story. And if that had happened, the end of this story would not have happened, right? And I could have stayed in London and continued to work with refugees and maybe I would have met somebody there or maybe not or whatever. I don't know. But then I wouldn't be here. And I wouldn't have had all the experiences that led me here. I wouldn't have met Paul. I wouldn't, none of this stuff would have been possible. So all of this was a process to kind of wean me away from my expectations and my idolatry of good things, but still an idolatry, to conform me to God's nature instead of my culture. And I believe it's the same thing for Naomi and the same thing for each one of us. But Naomi doesn't get this yet. She doesn't have the distance from this experience that I now have from mine. And so God is going to give her a living human picture of who he is and what he wants for her. She doesn't understand that yet either, though, so she tries to push that very person away. She's very well-meaning, she loves her daughters-in-law, and she is trying to impose her expectations of the good life on them. Then Pleasant said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return, each of you, to the house of her mothers. May Yahweh do chesed with you, just as you have done with the dead and with me. May Yahweh give you, and may you find rest, each in the house of her husband." And they're like, no, we love you. We'll go with you instead. And she says, they say, with you, we will return to your people. They've never been there before, but they're willing to do this. And then she insists, return, my daughters. Why would you go with me? Even if I still have sons in my womb, could they be husbands for you? Return, my daughters. Go. And then she comes up with this really implausible scenario, which the point of it is, it's really implausible. She knows that this is impossible. She basically says, so imagine I met another guy to marry tonight, and we somehow managed to conceive, even though she's older, somehow we managed to conceive two boys, and then you guys are going to wait until they grow up? Let's think about this. Even though people may have married much younger back then, if Naomi and Orpah married at even 12, they would be 22 by this point, which means that if somehow Naomi were miraculously able to have two baby boys right then, these two ladies would be 22 years older than their husbands and totally unable to have kids, which is the whole point of this, right? So she's just making this crazy scenario on purpose so they know, like, going back with her is not a good idea. There is no future for them in this. But they could go back home and they could meet somebody that's age appropriate and they could live the good life. They could live the way the culture expected them to live, have families, carry on their family's name. That would be great. What she's basically saying is, I love you, and we all know there is no life for a woman without a man. In this time period, that was true. She's not saying in this society there's no life for a woman without a man, because that's just how it was then. There's no concept of anything else, but she is saying, she's not saying go back to the house of your fathers, she's saying go back to the house of your mothers, and I read up on this. The significance of this is the house of the father is where you go if you are an aging, unmarried woman with nobody, no male to take care of you, or you're a widow and you have no male to take care of you, but your father's still alive, or something bad happened to you, like you were raped or divorced or something like that. The house of the mothers means there's still hope, because the mothers were involved in planning the marriages. And so she's saying, go to your mothers will find someone else for you to marry. There's hope for you here. You can still have a life. She's saying, I am too old for anything good to happen to me, and if you go back with me, you're as good as dead like I am. But you are young enough to find new husbands, so return to your families and make some families so you don't end up in this mess that I'm in. Naomi has a very narrow view right now, and this is what happens to us when our expectations are overturned and bad things happen to us or we're disappointed. We tend to only see like this. We can't see the big picture. We can't see any other possibilities. Naomi doesn't understand the extent of the chesed of God. She gets maybe that it's great enough to provide bread for her nation, but she doesn't get that God's chesed is personal enough to also provide for some unknown widows with no men to take care of them, two of whom aren't even members of the people of God. She can't imagine a functional existence outside of her own understanding of how life works. She believes that the only way life works is under the authority and protection of a man. So maybe if she has a concept of God's chesed, she thinks God gives the man chesed, and then the man gives it to the women and the children and whoever. She thinks that it's not for her. And it turns out that Orpah basically thinks the same thing. She seems to genuinely love Naomi, but she realizes that Naomi is giving her a very practical way out of this problem that they're all in. It's practical. It makes sense. It is a solution. It's going to enable her to continue to have a life. So she returns to the life that she knows and understands, to her own mother's house, where there might be a possibility of meeting somebody else, to her traditional gods. But Ruth has a bigger view. We don't know where she got this bigger view. She must have picked up something about who God was through the influence of her mother-in-law. Even though that same mother-in-law right now can't seem to imagine for herself what God is really like. So Ruth clings to Naomi, and I love the way Wendy's translation sounded. Refreshment clung to her. Naomi is not getting this, but refreshment is clinging to her. Maybe Ruth had, at some point in their relationship, expressed an interest in Yahweh before, because as soon as Orpah leaves, Naomi changes her argument tactic. She doesn't say, hey, really, you need to go find a husband, go home, that's the only way you're going to find a husband. She says, Look, your sister-in-law returns to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. Those are your gods. This is my God. In a minute, we'll see that she's so mad at God that it probably is not like she's saying, stay away from my God, you're not worthy of him, but more like, stay away from my God, he's not worthy of you. She is just saying, please go back to what you know, please go back to those other gods, because this one is making my life miserable. You would be better off with those gods over there than with my letdown of a God. But Ruth said, do not pressure me to abandon you by returning from following you, because where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people, my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may Yahweh do to me, and more so, if anything but death separates us. This is famous, and this is beautiful. And it is striking because this often gets quoted in weddings, but this is not a commitment in a wedding. This is not a romantic promise. This is a promise, as we said last week from Paul Miller, this is love without an exit strategy to a mother-in-law who has no future that anybody can see. And where in the world did this come from? Naomi is urging Ruth to return to what she knows, and Ruth wants to return to somewhere she's never been because she loves Naomi. She is giving up her entire identity and future for this woman who is pushing her away. We don't know whether Ruth's self-sacrificial love came first because she was captivated by Naomi or by Naomi's God. We don't know. Either way, Ruth is making a choice that makes no practical sense at all. Choosing to return with Naomi rather than Orpah is, from any natural point of view, both social and financial suicide. Either way, Ruth is making a choice that shows in real practical terms what the Hesed, loving, faithful, merciful character of God is like. Jesus described it, as we've said over and over and over again this year, greater love has no one than this, that a person lay down their life for their friends. This is what Ruth is doing. She is laying down her life for Naomi. She would rather return with Naomi to a place and a people and a God she doesn't know than return with her sister-in-law to the place and the people and the gods that she came from. But the only way to follow through on this choice is to lay down her life for Naomi, to take on Naomi's own experience of optionless widowhood, poverty, and being a foreigner. She is taking on another person's problems, another person's grief, another person's pain. Ruth has no way of knowing that her life will be any different than Naomi's is right now. She has no way of knowing this. She doesn't know even whether Naomi's people will ever accept her. She is a Moabite, after all. There's not a good history, right? We already talked about this. She has no way of knowing whether Naomi's God will accept her if she gives up the faith that she grew up with. And she doesn't even really know if Naomi will accept her. Because Naomi's been pushing her away this whole time. And it says, Wendy's translation said, when Naomi saw that Ruth insisted on going with her, she stopped arguing with her. But in parentheses, Wendy wrote, she stopped speaking to her. So she did stop arguing with her, but maybe it's possible they just walked the whole way from Moab to Bethlehem, Naomi not even talking to her. So Ruth is still going, in spite of all of these obstacles, all of these odds. Ruth is showing us Christ, right? This is exactly what Jesus does for us. He takes on our grief, our burdens, and our pain, and we don't even recognize him half the time and push him away, and he still pursues us. He still loves us. He still wants us to be with him and experience his merciful, faithful love. So the two of them went on until they came to the house of bread, which we know is Bethlehem. When they entered the house of bread, the whole city was abuzz over them. The city women said, "Is this pleasant?" Not really. 10 years later, and they can't really recognize her. And it's probably partly because she's aged, and probably partly because she's not the same person that left Bethlehem. Sometimes, even a man or woman of God can become so bogged down by our difficult and disappointing circumstances that we totally miss what God has done in our lives in the past and what God is doing in our lives right now. And this chapter concludes with two different descriptions of what Naomi's true situation is. We get Naomi's version, and then we get the narrator's version, which is pretty much God's version of what's actually happening. So Naomi says, "Don't call me pleasant. Call me bitter, for Shaddai has made me very bitter. I went out full, but empty Yahweh has brought me back. Why would you call me pleasant when Yahweh has afflicted me and Shaddai has caused me so much misfortune?" Naomi has returned home. She's chosen to return because she heard that Yahweh visited his people. But now that she's back, she's talking as if he dragged her back here. And she bitterly blames him for all of her losses. I actually can resonate with this too. I feel like this was probably me for at least 3 years after I came back from London. Naomi has a totally inaccurate memory of how she has gotten to this point. She and her family left Israel in the first place out of some kind of disobedience to God. We don't exactly know all of the elements, but we can tell that this isn't something they were supposed to be doing. They left because they were already empty. They were literally empty because there was a famine, so there wasn't enough for them to eat. But it seems like their nation, at least, and probably this family too, were spiritually empty. Just like when the Israelites were rescued from slavery and they whined about it in the desert and said, "Oh, if only we were back in Egypt where we could eat cucumbers." Cucumbers in slavery? Or getting out, no longer being slaves. They did that. She's kind of doing the same thing. She's pining for her husband and sons, maybe, and in her current spiritual desert, she's unable to see the reality of the lack that she was already in before this point, before they died. This is also kind of like Jonah was unable to see that he needed the mercy that God was giving the Ninevites. They both needed it. They were both equally in need of it. But also like Jonah, Naomi is getting in touch with her true spiritual state. She is bitter. She knows she's bitter. She's saying she's bitter. In this truthfulness, there is hope. I've worked with hospice patients before who I've been able to tell are really angry at God, and the ones who say, "Yes, I am actually angry at God, and this is why," usually have a much better trajectory at the end of their life than the ones who say, no, I'm not angry at God. I would never get angry at God. So Naomi is in a place of hope, but she's not out of the woods yet. Even though her bitterness is keeping her from seeing it right now, in a beautiful irony where the character has no idea what's going on, but we the readers can see it, just as she bitterly blames God for afflicting her with emptiness, the narrator reveals to us that really, she's being set up to be more fulfilled than she's ever been in her life. So pleasant returned and refreshment, her Moabite daughter-in-law with her, who she maybe hasn't spoken to yet, and she's certainly not acknowledging when she talks to the women in Bethlehem, the one who had returned from the fields of Moab. Now they entered the house of bread at the beginning of the barley harvest. That line right there is so beautiful because it's like, hey, I have a secret. It's the beginning of the barley harvest. She doesn't get this. She's all bitter. But look, the barley harvest. There's going to be a harvest. God is going to fill up Naomi's life with joy and plenty, but right now Naomi is totally unaware of this because the way God will do it is completely outside of her experience and outside of her understanding and outside of her expectations of the good life. And God is still showing her chesed, loving kindness and mercy, and providing for her spirit a young daughter who loves her with exactly the same kind of love that God has for her, love without an exit strategy. And God is showing them both chesed in bringing them back to the land, specifically to the house of bread at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now we know that even if this story didn't start out the way we, or Naomi, might have expected, it is a return to hope and to fullness and to refreshment. So this is kind of a spoiler alert, but we're moving into our time of communion, and we already know this. Ruth, living in the house of bread, is a distant ancestor of someone else famous who was born in Bethlehem, the house of bread, Jesus, the bread of life. Jesus was both fully God and fully human. He was both from here and not from here. And Ruth foreshadows the Hesed nature of God that is going to be expressed in her great, 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 million times great grandson, Jesus Christ. In laying down his life for us on the cross, Jesus opened up the way to hope and plenty for all of us, even if and even when our circumstances make us feel like God is against us, God is afflicting us, and we are bitter and empty. This morning we are celebrating together that Hesed love of God ultimately poured out for us in the body and blood of Jesus Christ. This table is open to all. Those of us returning to it anew because we know we need this continuing reminder, and those of us returning to Jesus for the very first time. It is only through his self-sacrificing Hesed that we can find ourselves in the renewed house of bread, with hope of his restorative presence and a fruitful barley harvest. You can't go home again, but you can go home for the first time. We are presented with the same options as Orpah and Ruth were given by Naomi. Return to the familiar life and expectations you've grown up with, you know, you understand, you can plan, or take the most glorious risk life has to offer, laying down your life for the one who laid down his life for you. Let's pray. Lord Jesus Christ, where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people, my people. Your Father, my Father. Through your sacrifice on the cross, which we commemorate today, where you died, I will lay down my life for you too. For I know that neither life nor death nor anything else in all creation can separate me from your love, Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.